I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. There were more street demonstrations in Caracas yesterday against Venezuela's President Nicolas Maduro, just a day after three people died in clashes. The country has been in a political crisis after the Supreme Court dissolved the parliament that was largely controlled by the opposition. Adding to the crisis is the economy that's in shambles with food shortages and a high rate of unemployment. The government seized a GM plant this week. The U.S. automaker said it was ceasing operations in Venezuela and will be laying off almost 3,000 workers. We asked Brian Ellsworth to join us. He's Reuters correspondent and he is based in Caracas. And Brian, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Are there demonstrations planned for today?
The demonstrations today are expected to be somewhat smaller. We're seeing maybe community-level demonstrations that follow what has been a week of relatively larger marches. So what has generally happened is the opposition has called sort of big marches in the morning, which attempt to reach certain government offices and are usually blocked by some combination of police and the National Guard, which after that they tend to sort of dissolve and dissipate into sort of smaller melees and kind of confused clashes between demonstrators and police with sort of clouds of tear gas and barricades being set up, trash being burned. Those kinds of things tend to stretch into the afternoon and then sometimes well into the evening. And then what we've been seeing over the last couple of weeks is late at night in working class districts, there have been some combination of this kind of clash together with looting of different establishments,
wow,
all of which are very confusing situations, not easy for us to report on for obvious security reasons. And in addition to that, there's generally a lot of noise on social media that a lot of it is true, but frequently there's information that's not correct there. So it's the sort of thing that we tend to watch from afar but can't get particularly involved in.
I mean, it sounds like what you're saying, Brian, is this is a dangerous situation?
It's very dangerous for the people that are on the street. I think a lot of the danger is going to be for people who live in the area of these demonstrations. It means that it's not uncommon for tear gas to be coming into people's homes or apartments. It means that people who are just bystanders frequently who are not involved in the demonstrations in any way may be targeted or may simply be hit by stray bullets. We've seen a number of instances of that appearing to happen in the last couple weeks, which means that there is pretty serious disruption of public order in a lot of places. It tends to be kind of low-level simmering demonstrations that you can be in one block and the place is literally on fire, and you go a couple blocks away and people are just sort of standing there chatting or going about their business. That means that it isn't a sort of, it's not an Aleppo type situation. This is not a serious civil war. It doesn't look like that. But it also means that you have no idea when something is going to break or when gunfire is going to go off. So it's a very dangerous and complicated situation for people living here.
Is it clear what the protesters in Venezuela, what they want? Do they want their president to leave their country or step down? Is this about elections? Is it just a protest because of the condition in their country?
There's a combination of different factors that you mentioned. There's been, for a long time, people have been very angry about the situation of the economy, which is taking on sort of a very Soviet quality to it. There's sort of rationing going on. There's hard to find food. There's supermarket lines. Inflation is not officially published, but people believe it's more than 800% per year. So there's been a lot of anger about that for a long time. This Supreme Court decision that you mentioned was in March was a big factor in triggering these most recent demonstrations. The measure effectively allowed the Supreme Court to take over Congress, which created such an international backlash that they very quickly walked it back. But by that point, people had already been angered by it. So we're taking to the streets and basically haven't left. Some days are more intense than others, but the demonstrations continue. So in addition to that, there's a demand that the government hold elections. Is last year, state governor elections were supposed to be held and they were not, which most of the opposition believes is because the Socialist Party wouldn't stand a particularly good chance with given what polls are doing right now. And this year are supposed to be municipal elections, and the presidential election would be scheduled for next year. What has also happened in the last week is that Enrique Capriles, who's the best-known opposition leader, was barred from public office on alleged misuse of public funds, which was locally and internationally perceived as a way of sidelining the opposition's best chance or most prominent candidate against Maduro. So there is increasing doubt among, I would say, perhaps a majority of Venezuelans that there will be free and fair elections in 2018 for president, simply because it will be the government will have a huge, heavy hand in determining who can actually run, given these disqualification mechanisms they use. So part of it is it's a combination of all these different things that people are demanding. So they also talk about the release of detained opposition activists who we would call political prisoners, that there's about 100 of those that have been behind bars, some of them for years. There's all this kind of collective, just a different sets of demands that are all kind of being made at the same time. Plus, there's just a generalized anger over the situation, as you've described it.
Well, let me pick up on a couple of things. You talk about the food shortages, which I'm sure leads to some level of anxiety, if not panic. Are people starving in Venezuela because of the food shortage?
Starving, I would say, is a relatively, that's a term. It's perhaps politicized. I might avoid it. But I think it's very, very clear that people are not eating the way they used to. This country was very prosperous during the oil boom, and the Socialist Party created a sort of elaborate network of subsidies and price controls that basically ensured people could buy significant quantities of food and quite a few often luxury goods people were able to afford. And Venezuelans were traveling around the world and spending cheap dollars. And that all changed after the collapse of oil prices. Mm-hmm. So what you have now is an economy that increasingly struggles to either produce food locally or import food. So if you're not really doing one or the other, there just isn't that much food available. So what has been happening is you'll see people lining up at supermarkets. There's some products that might be available at subsidized rates, but they tend to disappear pretty quickly. You'll see people walking around, knocking mangoes off of mango trees. You see routinely people poking through trash on the street of Caracas in any number of parts of town. It's simply people are not eating. You can see people are losing weight. People will say that they're not getting the kinds of food that they want and skipping meals, not eating so their children can eat. Or a lot of what's happening is people have started subsisting heavily on starches, so things like manioc or plantains, things that are relatively available in Venezuela, easier to find than something like wheat, which is not grown in Venezuela, so it's imported. Bread is kind of difficult to find. Rice is really difficult to find. So what people resort to are sort of these locally grown starches or whatever they can find.
That is so worrisome, obviously. Are people, especially people that might have some wherewithal, might have money, a middle class or more upper class Venezuelans, are they leaving the country either for neighboring countries or maybe coming to the U.S. or other countries?
There has been a steady migration for, I would say, more than a decade, which is difficult to quantify because no one has clear numbers on how many people are leaving, and it's a bit of a controversial issue. It is very clear from an anecdotal level when you simply look around trying to find a professional in a given area or someone who just literally even like a mechanic or a plumber, you routinely come across the fact that so-and-so is now in another country. They've gone to, I don't know, the United States is a frequent destination. Panama has been for a while. Mm-hmm. Argentina is an increasingly popular one because people can, because of the Mercosur arrangement, effectively can work in Argentina without requiring visas or any of that sort of thing. So that's definitely been going on. And that, as you say, sort of middle class and upper class folks have been leaving the country for quite a while. The difference we're seeing now is that a lot of working class folks are even getting on buses and driving to Ecuador or Colombia just to just because they don't see an opportunity here anymore.
I want to ask you a couple more questions about the political situation there, but let me play something that Senator Marco Rubio said yesterday. This is about handling this deteriorating situation in Venezuela. He was on a Fox News special report. He mentions OAS, and I should say to our listeners, that's the Organization of American States. Let's give it a listen.
And what I'm asking for, and have been pressing the administration to do, and they've been begun to do, is to ask our allies at the Organization of American States to convene these hearings that the Organization of American States is asking for, and invoke the Democratic Charter, and say that democracy in Venezuela no longer exists, and they must meet these conditions, or they will be expelled.
What do you think about that? And by expelling, let's say this happens, would expelling Venezuela from the OAS, would that in any way help the situation there?
The OAS is not a particularly powerful institution. It would have very deep symbolic impact for Venezuela, but it would not, I don't think, significantly change either the economic or political situation on the ground. The reality of the OAS expulsion is that it has been in discussion for, I would say, more than 6 months. The problem that the people who are supporting this find is that the OAS is made up not only of Latin American countries, but of relatively small Caribbean countries, which many of which benefited for years from basically subsidized fuel and assistance from Venezuela, particularly during the oil boom. And many of them retain support and continue to remain loyal to Venezuela. So what ends up happening when they propose this is that they need a two-thirds majority that they can't get to expel Venezuela, because the Caribbean nations and a number of leftist Latin American nations are too big a portion of the votes. So It ends up, it dominates a lot of discussion. It gets quite a lot of attention in Latin America. But at a practical level, I don't personally see how an expulsion from Venezuela would force Maduro to resign or force him to change anything. The OAS has for a long time, particularly by the Latin American left, been pilloried as a just sort of stooge of Washington. They would note that it is in Washington, which as an organization that's supposed to represent Latin America does create obvious concerns for a lot of people. So I think if Venezuela were expelled, it would probably respond by saying this is an institution that represents the interests of the United States and not Latin America.
Brian, we're almost out of time and an unfair question here. How does this end? How do you see this crisis ending?
Yes, that's perhaps an unfair question, and I'll offer an unfair answer, which is that I have no idea. I think the political system is I see it increasingly difficult for a political solution, given that there are fewer options available now that leaders are being removed. It's not obvious to me how the political situation would change through the institutional mechanisms. The opposition is at the same time, I think, hoping that these street protests will eventually lead Maduro either to resign or be forced out. At the time, I don't see that happening either.
Well, Brian, I appreciate you joining us today in Radio Times, and stay safe there in Caracas.
Thanks very much.
You're welcome. Brian Ellsworth, Reuters correspondent based in Caracas, Venezuela, talking about the political and economic crisis there. Scott Shane from The New York Times waiting in the wings. We've got another thing to talk about after this very short break. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moss Cohen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. A year ago, very few people had ever heard of Carter Page, who was a foreign policy advisor to the Trump campaign. He's now in the news because the FBI has been investigating him after getting a FISA warrant last fall. This was following a trip Page took to Russia, where he gave a speech criticizing the U.S. and favorably compared Putin to President Obama. Page had previously done business in Russia. Our guest Scott Shane wrote in the New York Times this week that a Russian spy tried to recruit Carter Page back in 2013. We asked Scott Shane to join us and tell us more. He's national security reporter for The Times. And Scott Shane, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Happy to be with you.
And to our listeners, you can call or text our comment line 267-405-2006. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY to join our conversation. Let's start with, who is Carter Page? Scott, he's got a kind of a mix of military service and time in business. Who is this guy?
That's right. He grew up in Poughkeepsie, New York. He attended the Naval Academy and did very well there, was sort of honored in a, was part of a selective program his senior year. He served 5 years in the Navy, and then he got a business degree and sort of went into business. He worked for Merrill Lynch as an investment banker in several places, but for this story, the relevant part is that from 2004 to 2007, he worked for Merrill Lynch in Moscow. And so he has sort of long-standing ties to Russia, business ties and other kinds of ties. And he, after leaving Merrill Lynch, started his own small energy investment firm called Global Energy Capital. And, you know, I think it's fair to say that, at least as far as we can tell, it was almost by accident that he got into the Trump campaign. As folks may remember, last year during the campaign, there came a moment when a lot of establishment Republican foreign policy experts were basically running the other way from Donald Trump. And he came under pressure to sort of say, well, do you have anyone, any experts on your side who are advising you? And he said, sure, I do. And an aide gave him a list of five names, and he read them out loud. And one of them was a guy no one had ever heard of named Carter Page, Ph.D.
Do we know how big a role how much influence Carter Page had on the campaign?
You know, as far as I can tell, very, very little. He, you know, he served the purpose of being a guy who Trump could name, who was, you know, had volunteered to advise him. But at least according to former Trump campaign officials, Carter Page never met Donald Trump. Page says he attended a couple meetings, large meetings, you know, where Trump was present, but they never conferred. He submitted some policy papers to the campaign, but I'm told that they, you know, were pretty much ignored. And subsequently, after Page began to get a little little negative publicity when the focus was on, you know, what was going on between the Trump campaign and Russia, Page stepped down from the campaign in September. So it seems to have been a very minimal relationship. But it has come back to, you know, it's fair to say, to haunt now President Trump.
Absolutely. I do want to play a clip. Actually, this is Carter Page talking with George Stephanopoulos. But I want to ask you, Scott Shane, about why and how did the FBI get this, this warrant to be able to investigate Scott Shane? That's not easy to do, to get a FISA warrant, as I understand it.
Yeah, well, I mean, I should set the stage by saying that back in 2013, long before the campaign, the FBI was, as it always does, routinely eavesdropping on people it had identified as in the United States as Russian intelligence officers. And this is completely standard. You know, it's hidden from public view. But all day long, every day of the year, the FBI and NSA, you know, are eavesdropping on targets, foreign intelligence targets. And so they had identified a guy as a Russian intelligence officer in New York City, and they were listening to him talk, and he was talking about how he'd met this American, and the American was Carter Page. And he was talking, essentially saying, I will approach him, I will cultivate him, I will recruit him as a source of information. So that, you know, first brought Carter Page to the FBI's attention, and it appears that the Bureau paid attention to him off and on. There's no evidence that Page was actually recruited as a Russian source or Russian spy in 2013 at that time. Certainly Page says he had no idea this guy was an intelligence officer in the first place. But, you know, so this guy was on the FBI's radar.
Well, let me just jump in here, only because, and from your story here, I'm looking at it. This Russian described him as an idiot. And I have to say, it seems like almost like a scene from the show The Americans.
It's very reminiscent of that show. And he says that Carter Page is a guy who has big business dreams. And, you know, he sounds like he's going to try to exploit Carter Page's desire to get in on some kind of lucrative business deals in Russia in order to, you know, sort of ensnare him, cultivate him, eventually turn him into a source. But again, it doesn't sound like anything, it doesn't appear that anything ever came of that. So then in March, Trump names Carter Page as an advisor. And then in July, after several requests, Carter Page is given permission by the Trump campaign to travel to Russia, you know, essentially on the campaign's behalf. And Page is clearly eager to cash in on his new association with the Republican nominee. And he's invited to give a lecture at a quite prestigious university in Moscow, and gives that lecture. And the lecture pretty much accords with Vladimir Putin, Russian President Vladimir Putin's view of what's gone wrong in U.S.-Russian relations under Obama. So it's actually something that happens at that during that visit, three-day visit of Carter Page to Moscow last July, that again gets the FBI interested in him, and indeed we're told is basically sort of the first step in what has become this much broader ongoing investigation by the FBI into the Russian interference in the U.S. presidential election, and the, you know, related question of whether anyone from the Trump campaign actually colluded with the Russians in the hacking and so on.
Well, let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Scott Shane. He's national security reporter for the New York Times, getting us up to speed on this FBI investigation into Carter Page. And probably by now you know that name and have seen him on TV. And again, you can call us or text us 267-405-2006. That's our comment line. Any questions or comments for our guest? Also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Well, let me play a clip, and this is from Good Morning America. It's April 13th, so it's last week, and this is Carter Page. He's talking with ABC News chief anchor George Stephanopoulos about this FBI investigation into his Russian ties and his trip to Moscow.
So let's fast forward to last summer. In order to get that wiretap, the FBI had to show probable cause, strong evidence that you were acting as a Russian agent. In your communications with the FBI, have you now convinced them you weren't acting as a Russian agent?
You know, I do not talk about any ongoing investigations. I will say that in terms of probable cause, there's been a ton of false evidence that's been out there, primarily in the public realm. But we shall see as, you know, as
these
reports come out.
But you know that they had to present this evidence to a court, to an independent court. They had to be convinced that this at least was evidence worthy of investigation. So what could they have been thinking of?
Well, there was tons of false evidence, whether primarily related to that dodgy dossier, which Senator Harry Reid last August sent to Director Comey. And who knows what the exact basis of? I really look forward to seeing it.
I want to pick up on the dodgy dossier, but let me go back to you, Scott Shane, and just how hard is it then to get a warrant from FISA? What kind of criteria do they have?
Well, essentially, this is a secret process where the Justice Department goes before this court, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, and presents evidence that there is probable cause to believe that some American is an agent of a foreign power or a terrorist group. So in this case, you know, they would have had to present some evidence that you know, Carter Page might be, this is far from proof, but might be a Russian agent. And I should say that they actually, interestingly, waited until Page stepped down from the campaign. He had attracted some unwanted attention, and he actually formally separated from the campaign in September. And that's when the FBI felt, which was very wary of you know, being seen to interfere in the actual campaign, you know, then decided, okay, now we can go to the court and get a court warrant. And it allows them to intercept phone calls, emails, any kind of communications as part of an attempt to determine whether or not Carter Page, you know, was a Russian agent.
How long do we know how long these kinds of investigations take or where they are in this investigation?
Well, this is, you know, now one part of a broader investigation into how Russia interfered in the presidential election, you know, basically a combination of disinformation and hacking. And then, as part of that, did anyone associated with Donald Trump have any, you know, role where they were helping Russia, consulting with Russian intelligence, any kind of hand, giving them a hand in the campaign? Because, as you know, the U.S. intelligence agencies concluded that this Russian interference was explicitly designed to hurt Hillary Clinton and to help Donald Trump. And so, you know, they were sort of on the same side in that sense. And folks will remember that as a candidate, Donald Trump took great pleasure in reading aloud before big audiences the emails, the Democratic emails that the Russians had hacked and released through WikiLeaks. So they were sort of, in a sense, on the same side. But what the FBI is trying to figure out is whether there was actually communication and collusion between the campaign and the Russians.
And here's this question that hangs over whenever there's this kind of a discussion about Russian interference in the presidential campaign, is why FBI director went public and frankly critical about Hillary Clinton and her server during the campaign, but he didn't say anything during the campaign about Russian interference. Scott, do you understand that reasoning?
Well, I mean, there's a sort of simple explanation, which is one that Comey and others have given, and that was that his initial statements about Hillary Clinton's use of a private email server when she was Secretary of State, well, you know, came at a time when they had closed that investigation. They had looked at it, decided there was no criminal violation. It's right that he sharply criticized her for being sloppy and casual in, right, you know, with classified information in handling her email. But he said, you know, no reasonable prosecutor would bring a case. So he was closing the case, and he thought that was, you know, important. This matter, you know, is still ongoing, has never been closed. And so that's the excuse or explanation that the FBI gives between the divergent approach to Clinton and Trump in that sense. But obviously a lot of Clinton supporters feel that was extremely unfair, that the public statements about Clinton gravely damaged her campaign, and that if he was going to talk about one investigation, he should have talked about the other, or maybe he shouldn't have talked about either.
Well, now it gets even more complicated because both the House and Senate Intelligence Committees are also looking into what the Russians might have done during the presidential campaign. The head of the House committee, Nunes, has stepped down. This gets very complicated here, but let me put this to you, Scott. So where does the House investigation stand?
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, there was this strange sort of dance in which Devin Nunes, the Republican chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, who, you know, presumably is supposed to be a fair and objective and neutral overseer of an investigation, an extremely sensitive investigation of the Russian hacking and the Russian intervention and the possible role of Trump associates. And he then, in the middle of this, went and met with somebody on the White House grounds and made some public statements that essentially were meant to give support to President Trump's, you know, kind of out-of-nowhere claim that President Obama had ordered wiretapping of him and his campaign, for which there's no evidence. So after, you know, so it looked like Nunes had essentially taken sides and was trying to exonerate Trump and his associates. So there was an outcry from Democrats, naturally. He agreed to step aside. The Congressional Ethics Committee is looking into this matter. And another member of the committee, you know, will sort of act in his stead. So the House committee, in that sense, is back on track. The Senate committee is working away. So you have, you know, two committees and the FBI all looking at this and trying to answer a question that we still don't know the answer to, which is this just a lot of smoke, sort of routine, you know, and chance encounters between various Russians and various Trump associates that don't add up to much? Or, you know, at the extreme, were there Trump associates who were directly working with the Russians to intervene in the campaign, undercut Clinton, and help Trump?
And we're almost out of time here, Scott. I mentioned the dodgy dossier, and do you think we will learn more about that, or the author of that dossier, who happens to be British, will he testify before any of these committees? Do you know?
I mean, that's a great question. I think he'll resist it, but it would be great to hear from him. This is a retired British intelligence officer named Chris Steele, who was paid by Trump's opponents to gather information about Trump and put together a dossier of unverified information that does say that, you know, certain Trump associates had a bunch of meetings with Russian intelligence and actively participated in the hacking and in the intervention in the election. Whether that's true or not, we still have no idea.
Well, Scott, we have to leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thanks, Marty.
And that's Scott Shane, and he is national security reporter for The New York Times. Robin Wright, waiting in the wings, will be talking about the Iran nuclear deal. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscowen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY.
I've been doing deals for a long time. I've been making lots of wonderful deals, great deals. That's what I do. Never, ever, ever in my life have I seen any transaction so incompetently negotiated as our deal with Iran. And I mean never.
That was candidate Donald Trump speaking at a rally in August 2015. He made undoing the Iranian nuclear agreement a centerpiece of his campaign. This week, the State Department confirmed that Iran had complied with the terms of the 2015 nuclear deal. At the same time, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson claimed the agreement fails to achieve the objective of a non-nuclear Iran, saying it only delays their goal of becoming a nuclear state, adding that Iran was destabilizing the Middle East by its alarming and ongoing provocations. The Trump administration is reviewing this agreement and will report back in 90 days. Well, we asked Robin Wright to join us. She's a journalist, author, has a joint fellowship at the U.S. Institute of Peace and the Woodrow Wilson International Center. And Robin Wright, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Great to be with you, Marty.
So help us understand. On the one hand, you've got the Secretary of State, or I should say the State Department, saying, well, Iran lived up to the deal. And then hours later, the Secretary of State says, well, it's a bad deal. Where does that leave the U.S.? Where does that leave Iran? And where does that leave this deal?
Well, it's been clear for a long time that the Trump administration intended to try to squeeze Iran further on the nuclear deal and on a host of other issues, including the nuclear tests, the detention of American citizens, and the support for terrorism, including groups like Hezbollah and Hamas. The nuclear deal is a complicated, long-term deal that the Trump administration is very limited in trying to change, because it was something negotiated by the world's six major powers. And the United States, by walking away, would probably only hurt itself more than help the issue of putting pressure on Iran.
How so? How so?
Well, part of the deal was to lift international sanctions, on Iran, which opened the door for foreign companies to go back in Iran, an oil wealthy country, and do deals. And Iran very much wants to be part of modern development. It's had to hold off on development projects. It also has a very hungry young consumer population. And the United States still has its own sanctions on Iran, but Europe, Asian countries particularly, have lifted their own sanctions. And so they would continue to honor the nuclear deal. They are very supportive of what may be a flawed deal, but diplomacy also always involves compromises that neither side ends up liking very much, but that facilitate the kind of diplomatic compromises that make deals possible.
Do you think then the U.S. in a sense is sort of stuck with the deal that the Obama administration negotiated?
I think at the end of the day, that's probably the case. But I also think that the Trump administration and Congress are both likely to try to, whether it's impose new sanctions, use far tougher language, pressure Iran on this host of other issues that will erode the spirit of the accord. And that's going to make it tough for Iran as well. Remember, the regime in Iran did not have total support on its side either for making a nuclear deal. It was hotly debated among the government, between the government of President Hassan Rouhani, who is a centrist, a cleric, but someone who pledged when he was elected to do a nuclear deal with the West, and hardliners who believe that any compromise with the outside world, particularly involving the West, will undermine the spirit of their revolution. And so this is something that is as politically contested in Iran as almost as much as it is in the United States.
As I mentioned, the Trump administration, or perhaps it's the State Department, will be reviewing this agreement and will report back in 90 days. Do you think that in 90 days they will decide to abide by this? I'm asking you to look into the future, which is really unfair, Robin Wright. But do you think they will end up abiding by this rule? And I ask that knowing that what candidate Donald Trump said on the campaign trail is different from what he has said as president on a number of foreign policy matters.
Well, the United States, as part of the deal, has to notify Congress regularly on whether Iran is complying. And that's why you saw this week this letter from the White House to the Speaker of the House notifying Congress that Iran has complied. And I suspect that Iran will comply very strictly to the specifics of the deal. It would not be in their interests, short term anyway, to violate the accord. Iran actually has a nuclear capacity. It does not have a weapon, but it does have the technology to make a weapon. And what the deal did was actually change the time frame. Instead of being able to make a bomb, within two to three months, the time is now at least a year. And that year is calculated to give the United States and its allies enough time to respond if they saw Iran moving in that direction. And they're now, the most thorough inspections of a nuclear program anywhere in the world taking place in Iran by the UN watchdog. And so it would be very difficult to cheat in really significant ways. So I think that the Trump administration can use whatever language it wants about Iran, on the nuclear deal anyway, but that it's going to find it very difficult because it also needs, whether it's the other European powers who are party to the talks or the Russians and the Chinese, for other issues, be it Syria, the South China Sea, and North Korea. We are part of an international global diplomatic community, and Iran is part of that, is one of the many issues that all of these countries have to consider.
This is complicated. Do you see any parallels between Iran and its nuclear program, such as it is, and North Korea?
Well, this is one of the interesting lines out of Secretary of Tillerson's comments this week. He said the same failed approach of the past that brought us to the current imminent threat we face from North Korea, in reference to Iran's program. Now, look, North Korea has a very active nuclear program that's still alive, and they have gone through 5 nuclear tests. That's something Iran has never done. A test is when you say a nation has crossed the nuclear threshold. Right. And so North Korea is way off in its own category as a rogue nation, as the Bush administration called it. So at this stage, Iran is not in the same place. I think the administration is trying to say it could go there. Well, the terms of the nuclear deal actually stipulate that Iran can't develop a whole range of different aspects required to make a nuclear weapon for various time frames, 10, 15, 20, and 25 years. But the deal in 3 different ways also stipulates that Iran will never develop a nuclear bomb. In some ways, because it has the capability, the kind of Japan model, it already has the psychological edge that it wanted in terms of its place in the region, its ability to kind of stand up to any threats from neighboring countries that the nuclear program really set out to achieve anyway.
Well, that's interesting. The idea that maybe that we're at least not building it now, but that we could, and that is sending a message of strength to the region.
But that it has the technology.
Right.
And that it is acquiring the technology that is really pivotal and that indicates that it could cross the threshold of a nuclear test if it wanted to. But in some ways, Iran doesn't want to. And I don't think at the moment there is any threat on its borders that would warrant the use of a nuclear bomb. And so it's kind of a moot point at this stage.
Let me ask you a larger question. We're coming up on the first 100 days of the Trump administration. Have you been able to glean a Trump foreign policy?
No, and I think one of the things that's difficult for all of us who are foreign policy analysts is to figure out if there is any proactive element that is consistent and that defines the overview. There is clearly a reactive component to Trump's foreign policy. He reacted to Syria's use of chemical weapons by using Tomahawk missiles. He responded to the ISIS threat in Afghanistan as it mobilized in a certain mountain range in Nangarhar province by using what they call the mother of all bombs. But, you know, and they've used a lot of very, you know, kind of brazen or bold language, rhetoric, in looking at the kind of threats around the world. But, you know, this is the reality is the administration still hasn't filled the vast majority of top positions at the State Department. There are other holes at the Pentagon, even some within the NSC. We don't have a new diplomatic corps, for example, that when it comes to the process of reviewing a new president's foreign policy, there aren't the people in place that are required to offer some really wise counsel on what is it that we can do, how can we be creative, and so forth. And so I think that's limited the administration. Normally a new president takes anywhere from 4 to 6 months to come out with the broad principles and of policy that and the specifics of how they frame the issues in the various regions of the world. And we're nowhere close to that yet. Even I think getting to that process, this is in many ways sticking their fingers in the dike and trying to stick their fingers in an awful lot of holes.
Could a policy, a viable policy, be, well, let's just keep the world guessing so they won't know exactly what we're going to do, but that will give us some advantage? And that seems to be coming out of the sort of art of the deal approach that the president has to a lot of issues.
That sounds appealing as a candidate, but the reality is, as a president, you really need to work with your allies. look at the way that President Trump has invoked China repeatedly when it comes to North Korea, that we can't go it alone, even when he talks about America first, that we need support, whether it's at the United Nations, for resolutions that set in place principles of international action, or the things that we define as the imminent threats, such as North Korea's nuclear and ballistic missile programs that could allow it at some point in the not-too-distant future to fire a nuclear weapon, not just at the West Coast, but at almost any point in the United States. And this is these are issues where we are part of a global community, and in the 21st century, it's just impossible to go it alone.
This is a question I and I think a lot of people have been asking in the last year or so. Do you understand now President Trump's real unwillingness to criticize Vladimir Putin? UN Ambassador Nikki Haley does. Other members of his administration have been critical of Russia and have been critical of Putin, but we have not heard that from the president. Do you understand that?
No. It's interesting. Secretary Tillerson also used some very critical language, even when he was on his first trip in Moscow, sitting next to his Russian counterpart. I was in Russia in February, and there was clearly a hope that President Trump would be friendlier to Moscow. But the realities of the tensions and the differences between Washington and Moscow are now increasingly clear, and it's hard for President Trump to talk around it. Now, does that mean he's I think he has moved on this issue, but clearly he's not prepared to use the language. I think he still has hopes, or as I would think of it, illusions about better relations with Russia. But whether it's over Ukraine or Syria and Iran, that on so many issues, the two countries just have core differences that will be very hard for any president to bridge.
About a minute before I have to say goodbye, do you know how President Putin views President Trump?
Well, I think it's clear from the reporting that the Russians had hoped that he would win the election. And I think that the Russians, it certainly sounds from the reporting that the Russians did everything they could to kind of sway our election. And, you know, whether it's with fake news or leaks about the two candidates.
Buyer's remorse? No. Do you think there's any buyer's remorse here?
Yes, I do, actually. I think there's a little bit. I'm not sure it's gotten to that point yet, but I think that there's a recognition in Moscow that President Trump may not be the ally that that Vladimir Putin had once hoped.
Well, Robin Wright, on that note, we have to say goodbye. Thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome. And she is a journalist. She's an author and a joint fellow at the U.S. Institute of Peace and the Woodrow Wilson International Center. She's a contributing writer for The New Yorker, author of a number of books, including Rock the Casbah, Rage and Rebellion Across the Islamic World. And that's it for today's edition of Radio Times. For more information about the program, go to whyy.org/Radio Times. And let me recommend that you download a podcast and check us out on Facebook Live. Earlier this week, yoga instructor Jessamine Stanley was here. She's a body acceptance activist, and you can watch us doing yoga with her if you check it out on Facebook Live. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us.